You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami. Our Moon, How Earth's Celestial Companion Transformed the Planet, Guided Evolution, and Made Us Who We Are, by Rebecca Boyle. I had two memorable experiences with the moon this year. The first was seeing the blue supermoon rise over Lake Michigan in August. The second, a few weeks later, was watching it quietly slip in front of our sun, casting the world below in an eerie, ethereal glow. Both of these moments left me with a sense of awe that I was not expecting. Frankly, I've always found the moon a bit boring. If you could study anything in the universe, I thought, the depths of black holes, faraway stellar explosions, or ghost-like particles called neutrinos, as I did, why on earth would you ever pick the unmysterious moon? But the science writer Rebecca Boyle proved me wrong. In Our Moon, Boyle walks the reader through a history of both Earth and humanity, from the formation of our planet and the evolution of life to the development of civilization, religion, philosophy, and eventually science. And through it all, she argues, the moon has played a starring role in how we came to be and who we are. The moon is more sibling than subordinate, Boyle writes, explaining that it formed out of the same cosmic cloud of debris that made Earth. Its gravity not only stabilizes our climate, making the moon captain of our seasons, but also enabled life. As ruler of the tides, the moon pulled primitive organisms into early Earth's nutrient-rich seas, then pushed them back onto shore, where the fish, out of water, walked. But Boyle, whose graceful writing is as lulling as a bedtime story, paints the moon as more than just a driver of physical phenomenon. Humans have always looked to our closest celestial neighbor, she says, to understand our place beneath it. Just as the moon reflects Earth's light, she writes, its primary role in modern science is to tell our story back to us. Ancient humans used the moon to harness time, which paved the way for organized systems like agriculture and religion, many forms of which worshipped the moon as a deity. By the time Galileo stood trial for claiming that Earth was not the center of our solar system, which he discovered in part by tracking lunar motion, the moon had already been divorced from the divine. People began to ponder what the moon was actually for and our own place in the universe. Ideas that our moon posits were the seeds of philosophical thought and early scientific observation. At times, the narrative meanders far enough away from the topic at hand that I wondered, what does this have to do with the moon? But just as that planet always reappears in our skies, so too does Boyle return to her subject. There is always some connection to be made, whether physical, spiritual, intellectual, or mythic. She leads us past the age of exploration, when going to the moon became an allegory for colonizing new lands, to the Apollo era, when the moon was a marker of political superiority. Boyle finds the moon in places I would never think to look, and she has convinced me that though our connection to it is ever-changing, the moon perseveres as a source of knowledge, wonder, and influence, and is anything but dull. Her book is a timely contemplation in the midst of a reinvigorated space race. This year alone, India became the fourth country to land on the moon, just days after a Russian spacecraft targeting its south pole crashed into its surface. Japan launched its own mission in September, and NASA has claimed that people will once again tread lunar soil by 2025. Once timekeeper, once deity, the moon, says Boyle, may soon occupy a new role for humanity, that of natural laboratory, a place to extract resources, and maybe someday another home. Today we glance at the calendars on our smartphones to keep track of time. We have no need to imagine what the moon might be like. For the first time in human history, we have data and videos, even paintings from people who have been there, to illuminate its nature. Its air of mystery is long gone. Why then do we still marvel? Maybe because it is the only piece of a vast universe that most of us will ever get to experience. All you have to do is look up. Or, of course, look down into Boyle's new book, which makes the moon feel closer than ever. This review was written by Katrina Miller. She is a science reporting fellow for The Times and recently earned her PhD in particle physics from the University of Chicago. Our enemies will vanish. The Russian invasion and Ukraine's war of independence by Yaroslav Trofimov. Kyiv was still a city at peace. Yaroslav Trofimov writes about the afternoon of February 23, 2022, the day before Russian forces invaded Ukraine. The sun was shining. The bars were full. He saw no scenes of panic buying at the shops or snaking lines at the ATMs. But like the title of his new book, Our Enemies Will Vanish, Trofimov's depiction of an idyllic Kyiv only emphasizes the brutal realities of the ensuing war. Trofimov is the chief foreign affairs correspondent at the Wall Street Journal and the author of two previous books, Faith at War and The Siege of Mecca. This time, as a Kyiv native, he has an intensely personal connection to his subject. It felt wrong to wear on the streets of my own hometown the vest and the helmet that I had donned hundreds of times in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other war zones, Trofimov writes, driving past locations from his Soviet-era adolescence, including the cinema where he watched Fellini films and the botanical garden where he had his first kiss. Long before the invasion, Vladimir Putin had depicted Ukraine as an artificial country that ultimately belonged to Russia. His territorial ambitions were further inflamed during the pandemic when he spent months of self-isolation reading the wrong history books, as Trofimov acerbically puts it. Trofimov has yet another personal connection to Putin's war. His colleague, Evan Gershkovich, has been detained by Russia for nearly 300 days, awaiting trial on charges of espionage that the Wall Street Journal and the American government steadfastly deny. Trofimov is candid about his own feelings of outrage toward Russian forces. How dare they, I thought. Our Enemies Will Vanish is clearly not an outsider's account, though as an experienced reporter, Trofimov mostly avoids the twin temptations of personalizing and pontificating, instead hewing closely to what he sees. He also provides some requisite historical context. The real start date of the war, he says, was 8 years before the 2022 invasion, in 2014, when Putin declared that eastern and southern Ukraine should be known as Novorossiya, or New Russia, and seized control of Crimea and Donbas. From those early victories, Putin took the wrong lesson. In 2022, Moscow expected to wrap up the whole operation in 10 days, which might very well have happened had Putin been satisfied with restricting Russian efforts to eastern Ukraine instead of setting his sights on the entire country. A limited war would have likely elicited only limited Western reaction, Trofimov writes. It could have also been won relatively quickly, causing a political crisis in Kyiv and a possible collapse of the Ukrainian government under Volodymyr Zelensky. Ukrainian forces had spent the 8 years since 2014 getting better training and improving discipline. They also established the territorial defense, made up of volunteers pledging to protect their local communities. By contrast, Russian hubris meant that even relatively minor obstacles forced them to pause, Trofimov writes. Moscow had assumed that capturing the northeastern city of Kharkiv would be so easy that many of the Russian troops had brought their parade uniforms. Instead of being greeted as liberators, they were resisted as invaders, and so the Russian military unleashed its fury. In March 2022, Trofimov arrived to find the city eviscerated. Most of the book chronicles his travels through Ukraine during the first year of the war, lingering especially on the chaos of those early weeks. He had to prove his identity to some fellow Ukrainians by saying the word for a bread that Russians apparently have a hard time pronouncing. staring down the Kalashnikovs of screaming police officers, he made a video call to an Interior Ministry official who vouched that Trofimov was not a Russian spy. As the war ground on, artifacts of a thriving economy began to look like cruel taunts. Amid the wreckage of Kharkiv, decapitated mannequins spilled out of windows, and a Nike billboard boasted, "We planned for everything." The book is divided into 48 chapters, spread out over 11 parts. Such fragmentation is a sign that the story Trofimov is telling is still unfolding, its arc still unclear. Most of the Ukrainians he quotes are adamant about repelling the Russian invasion, including some who had been supporters of Putin's Russia before February 2022. One Russian-speaking mayor of a Ukrainian town scoffs at the Russians and their imperial mania of greatness. But Trofimov also meets Ukrainians living in places where the Russian takeover had been quick and painless, whose lives were severely disrupted only after the occupiers withdrew. The desire for stability is a constant, Trofimov finds, fueling fearful collaboration with the Russians in some cases and fierce resistance in others. A morgue attendant in Mykolaiv, a city near the Black Sea, gestures at a pile of cadavers brought back from the front line. "Now we can go to a shop that is full of goods or buy a cup of tea," he tells Trofimov. "We are free to walk the streets." His point is that the return of ordinary pleasures is a hard-won victory, but it is also provisional. Trofimov describes a bustling promenade in one paragraph and bodies being pulled out of the rubble in the next. The book's title is a line from Ukraine's national anthem, "Our enemies will vanish like dew at sunrise." Trofimov clings to this rousing sentiment, even if the war reporter in him is constantly reminded that conflicts never work out that way. "A long, grueling fight lay ahead," he writes at the very end of the book. It's a sober, plain-spoken assessment that doesn't tell us all that much, which is also what makes it honest. This review was written by Jennifer Zelai. She is the nonfiction book critic for The Times. Filter World: How Algorithms Flattened Culture, by Kyle Chaika. This dispatch began from an uptown location of Dig, formerly Dig Inn, a small chain of fast casual restaurants headquartered in New York City. The walls are white painted brick, the tables are marble, and the cardboard bowls are packed with colorful, healthy foodstuffs. Only the insipid pop music that blares through the speakers discourages lingering. After reading Kyle Chaika's new book, Filter World, I understood more thoroughly and ruefully why I had chosen, or thought I'd chosen, to go there, and not, say, to the more idiosyncratic local Eli's down the street with its delicious, if overpriced, turkey chili, absence of Wi-Fi, and eccentric neighborhood dowagers rustling the cellophane. No shade to Dig. No shade would be possible anyway, given all those gold-stemmed hanging lamps, but everything about the place, including lopping the cute pun from its name, has been optimized for the phone, this device that most of us have given up trying to resist or relinquish for something less powerful and just tiredly accept as an extension of our brains and bodies. Dig's food, our feeds, their appetizers, our apps, they are all of a piece. Chaika has visited a lot of establishments with a similar aesthetic, which he has dubbed airspace, like a Nike sneaker, for its geographically neutral comfort. His previous book was about minimalism as a response to the world's chaos, along with considering artists, composers, and entrepreneurs. His research included visiting rock gardens in Kyoto and floating in a sensory deprivation tank for an hour. Here he has tried something more radical, an algorithm cleanse, during which he cut himself off entirely from Twitter, Instagram, Spotify, et al. For a few months. FOMO was too light of a phrase. Chaika writes of his anticipatory dread, "I feared, against all evidence to the contrary, that not to be on social media in the constant way I had been, always participating in the communal feed, would be not to exist." Spoiler alert, he survived, and has joined Threads now as well. Hey, a writer's gotta make a living. The medium is the metrics. But even to type spoiler alert is an example of the language degradation, the slang and cliché that social media has so dramatically accelerated. Filter World, which itself sounds like it could be an airspace cafe, is Chaika's term for how big tech shapes and limits our interests, corralling the chaos of the world into a pleasant user experience. Amazon, Netflix, and their ilk gather data from us semi-witting acceptors of all cookies, then chew it up and, like gigantic hovering mother birds, feed back more of what they calculate we'd like. Crumbs, mush, making our lives perhaps easier, but incalculably worse. Trying to quiet algorithmic anxiety and 24/7 digital overwhelm, Chaika posits we tend to take refuge in the average. Our natural reaction is to seek out culture that embraces nothingness, that blankets and soothes rather than challenges or surprises, as powerful artwork is meant to do. His book urges us to throw off the blanket. Not easy when it's a $300 weighted Barabee some influencer has convinced us is a necessity. As an algorithm alternative, I can offer that if you liked Nicholas Carr's The Shallows and Jenny O'Dell's How to Do Nothing, you'll probably be interested in Filter World as well. Chaika distinguishes himself with his focus on the old-fashioned idea of taste, revisiting, among many other works, Pierre Bourdieu's Distinction, the coppery-covered classic of sociology that many a college semiotician toted around ostentatiously in the 80s and 90s. He wants to restore value to the act of curation, another word with etymological origins in caretaking that has become increasingly cheapened. And so he walks through MoMA, like a medieval peasant traveling to a cathedral, but now with a professional curator, and meets with a beloved radio DJ whose voice reminds him of the green felt on a pool table. Small acts of resistance, like me and my laptop migrating from Dig to the underfunded public library against the online slideshows and playlists that dominate our days. America has let the algorithm run amok. As with sunscreen and childcare, it seems, Europe is doing a better job regulating this. So, Chaika suggests, we have to choose more conscionable platforms. Unlike the cascade of content from strangers on the internet, Filter World, as a proper book will, evokes less transient impulses than genuine lingering feelings, depression about our big box corporate dystopia, admiration for Chaika's curiosity and clear writing style, dismay about the electrical engineering graduate, electrical engineering, who can't get astrology out of her timeline, and regrets being influenced to buy a pair of leg warmers. I just want to know if what I like is what I actually like, she tells him plaintively. But it also made me feel old, or, let's put it another way, acutely conscious of generational divides. Chaika, a millennial, is nostalgic for the binder of CDs he had as a teenager, the images he once shared on Tumblr, an earlier, jankier, worldwide web of illegal file sharing, blogs, and massive multiplayer online role-playing game forums. He first heard My Favorite Things, not in The Sound of Music, but the John Coltrane version, listening to an indie station as he wended his way back from a friend's house in the suburbs in the early 2000s. Boomers and Gen X, with more years logged algorithm-free, might find Filter World unduly bleak. Zoomers, hopelessly naive. Or, as they say on the internet, YMMV. Your mileage may vary. A way of saying people may experience a particular thing in different ways. This review was written by Alexandra Jacobs. She is a book critic and the author of Still Here, The Madcap Nervy Singular Life of Elaine Stritch. Ilium by Leah Carpenter. The end of the Cold War may have been a godsend for the world, but it sure was a buzzkill for spy novelists. Now, thanks in part to Vladimir Putin, the KGB officer and aspiring Bond villain who ascended to president of Russia, a guy who, before invading Ukraine, was accused of executing an adversary with radioactive tea, the Russian boogeymen have returned. Leah Carpenter clearly knows the world of espionage well. Her Her books, particularly her 2018 novel Red, White, Blue, are rich with nomenclature of intelligence and undercover operations, but they are not, by design, page-turners. They are character studies of newbies thrust suddenly into the twilight world of special ops and fake identities, and the people they think they know are in fact mysteries themselves. On the surface, Carpenter's new novel, Ilium, is a tale of a CIA-led plan to assassinate a Russian, one of the most decorated and in-demand killers of his generation, his name spoken in hushed, rageful tones. Now, blessed by a series of increasingly powerful admirers, he's a 50-something oligarch living in an elegant but well-protected compound on a slim peninsula off Bordeaux, going by the name Edouard. The plot to execute him, however, is what Hitchcock might have called a MacGuffin, an element of the story that feels critical but will soon prove to be merely the way into something deeper and more interesting. Enter our unnamed British narrator, a woman, barely 21, who comes from limited means. Her mother is the personal assistant to a wealthy widow, but assistant was a euphemism for housekeeper. Our narrator confesses to placing pins in maps, New Caledonia, Cappadocia, St. Petersburg, planning someday to leave her family's gray lives and enter the world of color, romance. She hungers to be the sort of woman who wouldn't look longingly at maps. She would take risks. She will, it turns out, be the perfect asset to infiltrate Edouard's French compound, but it's not simply because of her nature. She has a physical attribute that I would be unsporting to share in a review. And when she's spotted by a 50-something CIA agent named Marcus in Trafalgar Square, the recruitment begins. I was the perfect one for the job, she admits. Not only did I look the part, I was what every case officer dreams to find in an asset. Naive, no strong ties, poor, I didn't even know myself. Her infiltration is the first step in Operation Ilium. Years before meeting the narrator, Marcus acquired the London home where her mother once worked, and the recruitment, either by destiny or design, becomes a whirlwind romance. She presumes her new boyfriend, and quickly her new husband, is simply a wealthy businessman. Nope. Soon after their tiny wedding in Majorca, while honeymooning in Croatia, he drops two bombshells on her. He needs her to pose as an art critic who can visit Edouard's French estate and provide reconnaissance on the property. Also, Marcus is dying. While Carpenter knows how to dish out the dread that a spy story needs, what makes Ilium intriguing are the characters. There are, of course, the agents behind Operation Ilium, such as Raja, recruited by M16 while studying in Beirut, and Jack and Jill, an Irish and a Ukrainian, who, imagine Rhys and Kerry Russell in the TV series The Americans, sometimes pose as husband and wife and sometimes as brother and sister, and usually are the most competent people in the room. But there is also Edouard's family on the estate, including his mysterious wife, Dasha, his stepdaughter, Nikki, and his delightful young son, Felix. When Marcus dies, part of the narrator's cover is to heal her loss with his family, into which she has insinuated herself. Even though they are aligned with her enemy, a man her late husband, and Raja, clearly loathed, she finds herself taking profound comfort from them, including Edouard. This is the sort of moral ambiguity that seems to fascinate Carpenter, the way living a double life and every day making your cover, that critical and deeply embedded lie, feels real to everyone around you. It's also what makes Ilium such an unexpectedly moving novel. This review was written by Chris Bohajalian, whose new novel, The Princess of Las Vegas, will be published in March. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.